This week on The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
The push to have bigger families and more babies is part of a movement called pronatalism. They are freaking out about declining global fertility rates. And that is real. It's a phenomenon called birth dearth. What's behind this push to start a new baby boom? Who are the voices pushing for a more pro-family America? And what exactly does that mean?
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, streaming now on your favorite podcast app.
Violence in Syria raises questions about the country's fragile new order.
There are real fears about the fracturing of Syria.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what the fighting means for Syria now that Israel has gotten involved. Also on the show, the view of the U.S. from Australia. It's an unreliable partner at the moment, so their prime minister is trying a reset with China.
The tightrope is only becoming even harder for Australia to manage.
Lava is flowing from a volcanic eruption in Iceland, and in Sweden, cash is not king. Some people there don't even know exactly what their currency looks like.
I could honestly not tell you what color or what prominent person is on them or anything.
But not everyone's on board with plans to scrap cash.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in today. We start the show in the Middle East, where a lot has happened in the past 24 hours. First, a stampede at a food distribution site near Khan Yunis in Gaza killed at least 20 people this morning. The site is run by the Israeli-backed American organization, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF.
GHF says Hamas caused the stampede by fomenting panic and spreading misinformation, but witnesses say people seeking food were trapped between locked gates and an outer fence. Mahmoud Abu Amara told Reuters how he and others were treated by GHF staffers.
Each one of them was standing with their weapons and standing watching us, firing pepper bombs at us while we were struggling, and they pushed us down.
This is just the latest of many deadly incidents at GHF food distribution sites around Gaza. UN human rights spokesperson Thamin Al-Kitan addressed the issue yesterday.
As of the 13th of July, we have recorded 875 people killed in Gaza while trying to get food. 674 of them were killed in the vicinity of GHF sites.
Fighting in Gaza also continues. 41 Palestinians were killed by Israeli airstrikes on Gaza City and Khan Yunis. The Israeli military said it had struck more than 120 Hamas targets across the Gaza Strip since yesterday.
Right now, we turn our focus to Israel's role in Syria, where a ceasefire has reportedly been reached between the Syrian government and the Druze minority. Fighting initially broke out yesterday in the south of Syria between Druze militias and local Bedouin tribes, killing at least 30 people. The Syrian government also joined the fighting, stoking fears a new government might oppress the Druze minority.
Israel says it wants to protect the Druze who live along its border with Syria. And to that end, Israel has been striking targets in Damascus, where plumes of smoke have been seen over the Syrian capital.
We asked journalist Ruth Michelson to help explain what Israel and Syria have at stake in this new conflict. She covers the region from her base in Istanbul and told me this was the third day in a row Israel has conducted airstrikes against the Syrian military.
We have seen warnings from the Israeli defense minister saying that there would be this expansion of strikes and that these were initially going to be warnings that the strikes would continue, and statements from the Israeli military that the strikes could even continue for a number of days. And I mean, frankly speaking, it's not especially clear how the targets of these strikes correspond to what they were initially saying. You know, why would hitting the presidential palace or something close to the presidential palace in Damascus, how does that help protect the Druze community south of the capital? Especially when, as you pointed out, we have now seen a ceasefire between the parties that have been fighting, between the government and Druze allied militias in Suweida.
A lot of questions. For listeners who might not be familiar, Ruth, explain who the Druze are and what connects them to Israel.
So the Druze are a religious sect that spans part of Syria and across the Levant. So they are found in large numbers on the outskirts of Damascus, in a neighborhood called Jarmana predominantly, down into Sueda, which is a province south of Damascus. And the Druze are also found in Lebanon and also in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. There are Druze in Israel who serve in the Israeli military. And so the Israeli authorities say that they are intervening to protect a community that has a presence in Israel, even if that is not necessarily a view that is shared by the Druze community elsewhere, particularly in Syria.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the Druze are part of an offshoot of Shia Islam. Why does Prime Minister Netanyahu feel an allegiance to protect them? Or did Israel launch these strikes on the Syrian military in Damascus for another reason that they're not talking about?
Well, I mean, it's more likely to be the latter. It is extremely unclear as to what motivates these strikes from an Israeli perspective beyond expanding the range of areas that Israel is now striking regularly. There are Israeli strikes on an almost daily basis in southern Lebanon. And there is also mounting pressure on Israel to halt or at least pause their assault on Gaza. And what it seems like the Israelis are doing, at least in the, you know, the last few days, is doing the exact opposite, which is expanding the range of areas that they are striking in territories nearby.
What is Israel's endgame here? Do we have a clear sense of that?
That is a very good question. I think what is troubling for most observers is that the answer to that is not very clear. There wouldn't appear to be a clear rationale, especially for the strikes that we have seen today. And because of that, it's also somewhat unclear what would make Israel halt these strikes. So, I mean, we've already seen today that the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said that Washington is very concerned by the fighting that they've seen in Syria, that there will be pressure and work to get the Israelis to halt these strikes. But given that it's not really clear what the rationale is for the strikes in the first place, what the desired endpoint is, and that we have now seen this ceasefire in Sueda, it's not really clear other than that what the Israelis would need to see to decide that they've done enough and it's time to stop bombing.
What is at stake for Washington in this conflict?
They have placed an enormous amount of political capital and stock on the idea that they have helped with the rebuilding of Syria by lifting economic sanctions on Syria, and that this is a gateway to allow Syria to rebuild after 14 years of civil war, after living under crushing dictatorship. And the lifting of sanctions was something that was beyond welcome on the ground in Damascus. There were even posters showing President Donald Trump's face that went up all over the country to celebrate that this happened. And so the Trump administration has really tried to say that their priority is, you know, a new beginning, peace and stability for Syria. And so these developments that we're seeing have put enormous pressure on the Trump administration to halt these Israeli strikes very quickly, because they absolutely undermine the stated aims of the administration to have this new, prosperous, peaceful Syria.
I mean, a couple of months ago, it seemed as if interim leader Ahmed al-Sharaa had some goodwill on his side to try and make things work in the country. Is that no longer the case?
I mean, it's clear that that is enormously under pressure. You know, this is really a time for the president to step up, to demonstrate the unity that this government says that it needs to see, because there are real fears about the fracturing of Syria. And that pressure is now only set to increase.
Journalist Ruth Michelson in Istanbul.
Fun fact, Sweden was the first country in Europe to print paper money. That was 350 years ago. Now it is close to scrapping cash altogether. The race to go full digital has some detractors. Critics say the digital divide leaves some people behind, and the growing fear of cyber attacks has others wondering if the dream of a cashless society is quite all it's cracked up to be. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
ABBA Museum in Stockholm is one of the city's top tourist attractions. But if you think you can use your Swedish krona there, think again.
You cannot pay your entry with cash here. Sweden would be the ideal country to make cashless.
Björn Ulvaeus, yes, that's Björn of ABBA fame, is so against paper money that when he opened the museum back in 2013, he made it cash-free from day one. Ulvaeus has since become one of the most famous faces behind Sweden's drive to go cashless. And today the country isn't far off reaching that goal.
Okay, I could honestly not tell you what cash looks like in Sweden. I cannot tell you how the bills look, what colour or what prominent person is on them or anything.
Moa Petersen lives outside Malmö in southern Sweden. She says she can't remember the last time she used cash. Petersen is associate professor in digital cultures at Lund University. Most of the coffee shops in Malmö have signs up saying card only, and many supermarkets now have just one checkout for cash. There's almost a stigma to standing in that line, she says. Petersen isn't surprised that Sweden's ahead of the pack when it comes to going cashless.
The Swedish self-image is to be a country of innovations, technology and tech savviness. And the politics of Sweden has been to be the best in the world in digitalization.
In 2012, a group of banks created the mobile payment app Swish. And that really accelerated the whole process, she says. Today, more than 80% of Swedes have a Swish account. But some in Sweden are suspicious about the motivation behind it all.
I think the major banks looked at each other and said, do we earn money on cash? The answer is, of course, no.
Bjorn Eriksson heads up a movement called the Cash Rebellion. He's also a former chief of police in Sweden. He says the banks saw an opportunity to make money from card payments. Supporters of a cashless society predicted that it would cut down on robberies and break-ins, and that turned out to be true. But Eriksson says,
when I ask my police friends, they argue correctly that the fraud within the digital sector is much, much, much bigger than crimes connected to cash.
Sweden's National Council on Crime Prevention also says online fraud has skyrocketed in recent years. Even the Swedish Central Bank now admits that elderly people are more at risk in a cash-free world. And they're not the only vulnerable group.
He controls her finances. He can see what she uses her money for.
Adina Samadi is with ROCKS, a national organisation for women's shelters in Sweden. She tells me about a woman she met a couple of weeks ago who was trying to flee an abusive relationship.
She had saved up money in cash and she and her kids were ready to leave. And when she got out of the home, she realized she cannot leave because she needed to buy a train ticket and a bus ticket for her and her children.
Buses and trains in Sweden take only cards. Samadhi says many women are also terrified that their abuser can track them down by monitoring their bank card transactions. Her organisation and others have been sounding the alarm for a while now, but it wasn't until threats came from outside of Sweden that many politicians seemed to take notice.
SVT, Sweden's public service TV broadcaster, has been subjected to another cyber attack. The Swedish Public Employment Agency and several banks have also been hit by cyber attacks recently, and the issue was raised this morning in connection with the party leader debate in Parliament.
Those recent cyber attacks led the country's Prime Minister to say that Sweden is under attack. He didn't say who he thought was behind it all, but intelligence services, he said, report that Russia, China and Iran systematically engage in this type of activity. Late last year, the government sent a booklet to every household in Sweden entitled If Crisis or War Comes. And one of its top tips, make sure you have cash on hand. Moa Petersen, the professor in Malmö, says it became a sort of a running joke.
There is no infrastructure. What should you do with that money? I mean, then we have to set up like a fast solution how to start to use cash again, you know.
With so many banks closing down and many ATMs no longer working, getting your hands on cash isn't that easy, she says. The Swedish Parliament is now considering a new law that would oblige some shops and other services to once again accept cash. Probably not at the ABBA Museum, though. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is visiting Beijing this week to reset relations with President Xi Jinping after years of tension between the two countries. We asked analyst William Yang to break down what's at stake for Australia and China. He's with Crisis Group and joined us from Tokyo.
So the purpose of this visit essentially is for Australia to try to strike a balance between its security interest and the economic interest. We know that in recent weeks and months, Australia has been facing increasing pressure from the U.S. to increase its defense spending to at least 5% of its GDP. And at the same time, the Trump administration has vowed to review one of the very iconic and flagship security partnership between the two countries and the United Kingdom, which is the AUKUS program. And so at the same time, the Australian government is seeking to expand its trade and economic avenues with its relationship with China. China is the largest trading partner for Australia for many years.
Yes, so Albanese both courted by the U.S. but also being pushed apparently into China's arms. So Albanese has taken heat from Australians for traveling too much, going, for example, on this visit to China for 6 days. But for Albanese and his advisors, this China focus is obviously an indication of how important this is for Australia.
Yes, exactly. I think the fact that he made this trip before he actually traveled to Washington to meet Trump puts a lot of emphasis on the fact that he does actually want to make sure that the Australian-China trade relationship and economic ties will continue to flourish. But there is a caveat when it comes to this trip as well. There are growing security-related concerns that Australia holds against Beijing. One of the main topics in this upcoming trip is the Chinese military's week-long exercise in the water between Australia and New Zealand earlier this year. And in Australia's eyes, that was very unprecedented for Chinese naval vessels to sail all the way down to that part of the world to conduct a week-long exercise without prior warning. China has a growing ambition in the Pacific region. China is trying to make security inroads to present itself as an alternative security provider for the very impoverished Pacific Island countries. Australia sees that as a major threat to its strategic interest. And so it does hold some concerns and also skepticism about China.
Yeah, so some strategic security road bumps there. What, though, is China hoping to get out of this relationship?
So this trip comes at a time that, apart from the pressure on enhancing defense spending from Washington, the Trump administration is also pushing Australia and also Japan to declare what sort of role do they actually expect themselves to play in a potential Chinese invasion against Taiwan. Hmm. These are exactly the type of issues that are putting Australia in a very uncomfortable position. So I think China is trying to convince Australia that the Trump administration probably does not really consider Australia's autonomy and also strategic independence, and China might actually be a better partner. At the same time, is a more reliable trading partner, because we all know that the recent tariff that the Trump administration has announced sent shockwaves across the region and pushed a lot of countries that traditionally have deep ties with the United States to somewhat reconsider what kind of partnership they should have with the Trump administration going forward.
Yeah, and as you've reminded us several times in our conversation, Australia is also a key ally of the U.S. in the region. How will that dynamic be impacted going forward after this meeting?
I think we will have to see how the Trump administration handles the very sensitive security issues in the bilateral relationship, including the ongoing review of the AUKUS nuclear submarine deal, because the nuclear submarine deal is in fact, the key part of the U.S. overall security strategy in the Indo-Pacific region when it comes to its competition with China.
And just remind us of the broad strokes of that deal. The U.S. supplied submarines for Australia, is that correct?
Right. The U.S. supplies the technology to Australia to allow Australia to acquire nuclear-powered submarines that will actually allow Australia to further project its military power further deeper up into the Western Pacific. And that is where the Australians will play a key role in a potential Taiwan contingency in the eyes of Washington. But at a time when the deal's future is being reviewed by the Trump administration, there's also a lot of calls within Australia on the government to perhaps consider what sort of partnership Australia wants going forward when it comes to the relationship with the United States. Because once it has a very definitive declaration about what sort of role it is going to play to support the U.S., that's obviously going to have huge impact on its economic relationship with China.
We should also point out that Australia is not the only U.S. partner in the region paying a visit to Beijing this week. India's external affairs minister is also there. What does that tell you, William?
I think the fact that two major Indo-Pacific partners for the U.S. send their highest level possible officials to China. We need to remember that India's defense minister and national security advisor were also in China in previous weeks for separate meetings. But during those meetings, they also met with high-level Chinese officials. I think this tells us that the uncertainty that the Trump administration is bringing into the partnership, including mixed signals that it is sending to these allies, is pushing these allies to reconsider maybe to improve relationship with China so that they have a little bit more bandwidth to cope with the uncertainties that they are expecting coming from Washington.
William Yang is an analyst with Crisis Group in Tokyo.
Here are a few items you may not have seen in the news today.
We're saying in Australia, where researchers say teens are putting down their vapes and passing on smokes. An anonymous survey of 3,000 young people showed 94% of 14 to 17-year-olds had never smoked or even had a few puffs of a cigarette. That is the highest rate ever recorded. Vaping has also decreased from 18 to 15% for the same age group in the past 2 years.
And do you remember that beloved sycamore gap tree in the English countryside that was cut down by vandals 2 years ago? Today, the pair was sentenced to more than 4 years in prison for their moronic mission. That's what the prosecutor called it, not me. Daniel Graham and Adam Carruthers, both in their 30s, were convicted for destroying the tree and damaging Hadrian's Wall, the UNESCO World Heritage Site where the tree stood. The judge said the sentence reflects the anger and sadness that so many people felt over the sycamore.
And a strange story of a Russian woman and her two young daughters who have been removed from a forest cave in southern India, where they've been living for more than a week. Police discovered the family during a routine patrol of a remote area in Karnataka state. A photo showed the woman, Nina Kutina, in front of the cave with red fabric of saris covering the entrance like curtains. Kutina said they spent their days painting, singing, reading books, and living peacefully. A local police officer said it is nothing but her love for adventure that brought her here. The family is now in detention for overstaying their visas.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
More global news is still ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Returning to our top story today in Syria, Israel has been striking military targets there in a campaign it says aims to defend the Druze minority. Journalist Ruth Michelson is covering the story from Istanbul.
The Israeli authorities say that they are intervening to protect a community that has a presence in Israel, even if that is not necessarily a view that is shared by the Druze community elsewhere, particularly in Syria.
Fighting has raged for days between the Druze, Bedouin tribes, and Syrian government forces, killing at least 30 people. A ceasefire has reportedly been reached today between Syria's transitional government and the Druze.
Also in the Middle East, a stampede this morning at a food distribution center in southern Gaza killed at least 20 people. The site near Khan Yunis is run by the controversial Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. The organization says Hamas caused the violence by fomenting panic and spreading misinformation. But witnesses and survivors say people seeking food were trapped between locked gates and an outer fence.
International aid groups have been critical of how GHF is operating in Gaza. This is just the latest of many deadly incidents involving food distribution sites. UN Human Rights spokesperson Thamin Al-Khitan addressed the issue yesterday.
As of the 13th of July, we have recorded 875 people killed in Gaza while trying to get food. 674 of them were killed in the vicinity of GHF sites.
Fighting in Gaza also continues, with 41 Palestinians killed by Israeli airstrikes on Gaza City and Khan Yunis. The Israeli military said it had struck more than 120 targets across the Gaza Strip in the past 24 hours. Those targets include tunnels and weapons storage facilities used by Hamas.
Find more of our coverage from the Middle East online at theworld.org.
Golden visas have been around for decades, but they really took off around the beginning of the pandemic. These visas allow people to buy residency or even citizenship in a country if they agree to invest in the country's economy. As the world's Bianca Hillier reports, it's recently gotten easier to get in on New Zealand's Golden Visa program.
New Zealand's new golden visa rules came into effect in April. Now, applicants do not need to speak English, they can spend less time in the country if they want to, and they don't have to invest quite as much money. Dom Jones, managing director of Greener Pastures New Zealand, helps people find those investment opportunities.
Those changes to the investment rules have made it easier and more straightforward for one to secure a permanent residency visa.
Easier, but still expensive. The visa application alone costs more than $15,000, and investors must put up a minimum of $3 million. Stu Nash runs Nash Kelly Global, an immigration and relocation consultancy. He says the whole point of this golden visa is for the money to be invested in New Zealand businesses.
There's everything from property managed funds, from lodges to vineyards to manufacturing businesses. You name it, there is an investment out there.
So far, the new rules have proven popular. Immigration New Zealand says they've received about 200 applications over the past 3 months. That's already a 63% increase from what they received over 2.5 years with the previous rules. Some people come from Europe, more come from China. But most applicants are coming from the U.S.
President Trump and a number of his policies, they often cite that as a reason why they're keen to take a break from the United States at the moment.
For some people, New Zealand offers a particularly attractive respite. There's beautiful scenery, a stable democracy, and safety.
There has never been a school shooting in New Zealand. Our police don't even carry guns. We've got a way of life which is very appealing for a lot of people.
New Zealand's government says the new visa could bring more than $500 million of new investment. Dom Jones says the country needs that money and the people who come with it.
We're a small country, right? So we have shallow capital pools. We don't have many people. And when this visa is working well, these investors spend a lot of time in New Zealand. And attracting those sort of skill sets is quite valuable to a small country like ours.
But one of the new rules is that investors are not required to spend much time in the country at all. Only 3 weeks out of 3 years, or 15 weeks out of 5 years, depending on the amount of money they invest. That's an issue for skeptics of the plan, like Phil Twyford of the Labour Party. He's New Zealand's opposition party immigration spokesperson.
The idea of liberal and highly educated Americans fleeing the Trump White House and making a new life in New Zealand, I find that quite appealing. But the way the current policy is written, you're giving people a retirement bolt hole if they put some money in the bank for 3 years. And that should not masquerade as an economic development policy.
Twyford points to countries like nearby Australia, which introduced a golden visa policy back in 2012. It came under scrutiny during the pandemic, and Twyford says authorities there found that after more than a decade, it hadn't really improved Australia's economy. But beyond the numbers, Twyford adds that the new golden visa rules in New Zealand don't align with the values of many Kiwis.
It's deeply distasteful for the government to be selling residents to wealthy foreigners. Is that what we're about as a country? Is that consistent with our values? I don't think so.
Immigration New Zealand says they will be tracking the economic impact of the new rules. Twyford says no matter how it plays out, that data will influence the Labour Party's golden visa policy as they hope to regain power at the end of next year. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Western Hungary, the Arch Abbey of Pannonhalma has been around for 1,000 years. It holds 400,000 precious books and documents in its vast library. Those volumes have survived multiple wars, but now an infestation of hungry beetles is munching away at the books and curators are racing to save them. Mate Vinca describes the situation at the Arch Abbey for us. He's Hungary's Deputy State Secretary for Public Collections and Cultural Development.
Well, the Archabbey has a library. It also has an archive. And in this archive, we keep the oldest Hungarian official documents from the 11th century. Because as you might know, the official language of Hungary at that time was Latin. So the bureaucracy language was Latin. So it's a very valuable collection of books. And I have to add at this point that fortunately, these most important and oldest documents are, of course, stored separately. They are not part of the infection, but the library, which was infected, still holds over 400,000 books. And some of these are, I could say new, but it's probably better to say newer, you know, only a few hundred years old.
So how did librarians or curators there realize that there was this beetle infestation?
Well, they realized it during a routine cleaning. They found marks of this red beetle, which we know previously from food security. It has not happened before in Hungary that red beetle would feast on books. But it turns out that this red beetle is quite happy with a temperature stable above 20 degrees Celsius, which I believe is about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And in this climate, the red beetle feasts on book bindings, which in some of these older books, these are made of animal products or animal-based products. And they feast on that, and they also reproduce in this climate. So the librarians found this infection, and very quickly we were able to find a technique to disinfect the books, which has not been used in this climate.
What is that technique? I think anyone who's ever tried to get rid of moths or ants in their house knows it's a big hassle. I can't even imagine how much bigger when you're talking about, 100,000 books. What do they have to do?
What they did is that they created tents of nitrogen and they put the books in those tents for 2 weeks. And after that fortnight, the bugs are dead. And now what they have to do, they are taking each book and by hand, they are cleaning it from the dead bugs as well as selecting them for restorations. Mm. It's a huge, huge work. And we expect the library to reopen not sooner than early next year.
Oh, wow. So you're basically depriving the beetles of oxygen to kill them. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
How much damage did these things do before librarians realized what was happening?
Well, we don't know the exact number yet, but we estimate that about 1/4 of the book collection was affected. Now, it may be that just the book bindings, which are very easy to restore, but it may also be that they laid eggs in the most beautiful pages or decorations, but we don't know this yet because the disinfection process is only finishing this week. And then the selection process will take place where the restorators will have to go through all the books one by one.
Mm. It's striking to me that these books have survived, you know, multiple world wars. The Arch Abbey itself was founded before the Kingdom of Hungary, over 1,000 years ago. Are you reflecting on everything these books have survived up until now, only to be felled by little tiny beetles today?
Of course, but as you know, surviving wars and surviving different kind of direct impact from humans, it didn't mean that the books were never had to be restored before. So every now and then these books have to be restored. And at this point, we are quite positive that we were able to catch this infection in time. Although some of these books look not as good as before, they were bitten, parts of it were chewed up by this bug, but the restorations are working on it and hopefully they will be able to restore everything.
Mate Vinca is the Deputy State Secretary for Public Collections and Cultural Development in Hungary. Mate spoke to us about the effort to save a library at a Hungarian abbey from bread beetles.
Affirmative action policies are a thing of the past at colleges and universities in the U.S. And even though the Supreme Court ruled race-based admissions unconstitutional 2 years ago, it remains controversial. But in Brazil, it's a different story. There, affirmative action isn't just alive and well, it's thriving. Michael Fox brings us a story from Rio de Janeiro.
In the entrance to the main building at Rio de Janeiro State University, students walk quickly back and forth to class. One thing stands out. The crowd of people is really diverse, just about every shade of skin color, a cross-section of the demographics of the state of Rio de Janeiro. And that is not by accident. It has taken years to get here. Wes Creportes is a sociologist who studied at the Rio de Janeiro State University and benefited from affirmative action there.
Historicamente, são universidades que não existiam pessoas negras quase, né?
Historically, there were almost no black people at these universities, he says. They were largely white and middle class and very restricted to this sector of society. Rio de Janeiro State University was one of the first Brazilian universities to implement a system of affirmative action in 2002.
I think it's been very successful.
João Ferris Jr. is the head of the Rio de Janeiro State University's multidisciplinary study group on affirmative action.
It totally transformed the face of public universities in Brazil and opened it up to people who were not there before. In other words, you know, non-whites and low-income people.
People like David Gomes.
Sempre fomos só minha mãe e eu. E fui morar no complexo da Penha.
It was always just my mom and I, he says. Gomes grew up in one of Rio's many favelas or slums. He was the first of his family to go to college through the Rio de Janeiro State University racial quota system. He graduated as a history major and went on to get his master's in urban planning. Today, Gomes is the head of the affirmative action department at the Rio de Janeiro State University.
Que o sistema de cotas me permitiu construir, agora também vou poder.
The quota system helped me to build a life, he says, and now I'm here to help others like me get into Rio de Janeiro State University and graduate, have a career, and also give back to society. Quotas at universities vary according to the school and the racial demographics of the state where they're located. In general, 50% of university seats are awarded based solely on academic achievement. 50% are allotted for the quota system, including people self-identifying as Black, Indigenous, and people with disabilities. And it has been a game changer. According to the 2022 Higher Education Census, more than 100,000 students benefited from racial quotas in Brazil just in the previous year. But from the beginning, affirmative action here was not an easy sell.
I remember at the time, people would just go on talking about how quota students would destroy the university.
Vania Peña Lopez is a Brazilian professor of sociology at Montclair State University. She says those against affirmative action said it would tank university performance and cause racial tension that supposedly never existed before in Brazil.
Because of the myth of racial democracy. Those who are against any kind of reparations, any kind of compensation, well, you can't compensate, would say, oh, you're copying the United States.
Brazilians long looked to the United States for inspiration on affirmative action. The policy was implemented in the U.S. following the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But there are some big differences between the two countries' programs. In the U.S., race was one of the factors used for admittance. But quotas were prohibited by the Supreme Court back in the late 1970s. In other words, U.S. universities couldn't set a percentage or a number of students who would benefit. Meanwhile, the Brazilian Supreme Court unanimously approved racial quotas at Brazilian universities in 2012.
Que foi algo muito positivo, que é a democratização do acesso da universidade.
This has been really positive, says Elaine Monteiro, a historian who studied at Rio de Janeiro State University through the quota system. The democratization of university access for the poorest people and for black people. But there has been pushback.
Cara, então, eu sou totalmente contra, entendeu? Porque eu acho que quem aplica a cota quando vai fazer uma prova.
In this clip from an Instagram video, a black sociology student from the Rio de Janeiro Federal University denounces quotas in Brazil, saying all you really need to do is study. Conservative lawmakers have also done their best to attack the policy. Senator Flavio Bolsonaro, the son of former far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, asked, "What about poor whites?" He says, "We can't create an apartheid for those people who don't have black skin or a disability and who sometimes live in the same favela and who studied in the same public school." Back on the Rio de Janeiro State University campus, those promoting racial quotas say racial division is far from what's happening here.
É que há uma efetividade das políticas, ou seja, essas pessoas, elas mudam de vida.
These policies are effective. They're changing people's lives, says sociologist Wes Creportes. Those benefited by the quota system go on to better jobs. They start to have a different degree of social mobility in relation to their parents. And that, he says, translates into a plus for society in general. Millions have been lifted from poverty in Brazil over the last 20 years, thanks in large part to affirmative action. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Iceland is known as the land of fire and ice. Lately, there's been a lot of attention on the fire part. A volcanic eruption in the southwestern corner of the country has forced the evacuation of about 100 people from the nearby fishing town of Grindavik. Tourists at the famous Blue Lagoon Spa nearby also had to flee. Dave McGarvey is a volcanologist at the University of Lancaster in the UK. He says today's eruption is part of a pattern.
What seems to have happened is that this area has been locked up, if you like, for almost 800 years, and it's done nothing in terms of volcanic eruptions. And then since 2021, we've had 12 eruptions, three at another volcanic system a little bit to the east, and now this is the ninth since December 2023 in this particular volcanic system. And what we're seeing is a repeated pattern of magma from depth, that's molten rock, accumulating in a particular area 3 or 4 miles beneath the crust. And then every few months, once that magma reaches a certain threshold or level, it escapes out and forms a crack along the ground and an underground tunnel, big long tunnel. In some places, the magma actually rises to the surface. But there's little variations here and there. We get little surprises, such as magma will squirt out and it won't come to the surface, or we get magma going much, much further underground, way beyond what anybody thought it would do.
So this is lava emerging from these cracks on the Earth's surface. It's not coming out of like a big mountain and erupting and spewing like kind of a more classic volcanic eruption that we might picture.
No, these are very much lava-dominated. And the sad thing is, in a way, the nine eruptions from this particular volcanic system, it's very much more difficult to forecast where the eruptions are going to happen. And so really, you can see them from a distance, but they're keeping people away from the actual eruption sites themselves because it's just not safe.
Is it clear why this is happening now after this system has been dormant for 800 years?
It's not particularly clear the underlying reason why it's happened, but what the suspicion is that whereas other parts of Iceland have an eruption every 4 or 5 years, nothing really happens here. It seems to lock up for 800 to 1,000 years, and then once it awakens, we get a period of maybe 2 or 3 centuries of occasional eruptions. During that period, then it locks up again. So it's a stop-start type of activity in this part of Iceland. And it's only the second time since Iceland was settled we've actually seen this. The last time was in the 12th, 13th century. That's what the evidence from the past actually tells us. We've seen this waking up over that maybe 200 or 300 years, and then everything goes quiet again. So I think most scientists in Iceland and around the world who study Iceland would say this looks like it's certainly the start of an event that maybe may last a century or more.
So this is, I'm sure, very interesting to scientists, but is also impacting the lives of people on the ground. About 100 people had to be evacuated today, I believe, because of this activity. How do people in this area learn to live with this kind of uncertainty that they might just have to pick up and leave?
It's pretty horrible, to be honest. I mean, the people of Grindavik suffered very badly before the eruption began, because in the lead up to eruptions, there were very large earthquakes. And what they have done is protect the town with a rather substantial barrier that encircles the town. And only once was that breached when a lamp flow erupted within the town and burned down three houses. But the state actually bought all the houses from residents from Grindavik, or at least the main residents of everyone who lived there, so that these people could move on with their lives. But what you've done, unfortunately, is you've had to basically break up an entire community of about 4,000 people because of eruptions. And that's a very large number of people for Iceland. I mean, that's actually about 1% of the population. Mm.
But you said that some people had to be evacuated from Grindavik last night, even though they were evacuated a year and a half ago or so. So have people returned there?
Yes, there's been a gradual return. And in the early days, there was very much uncertainty about whether people should be going back or not. And eventually it became clear that people can come back and start to rebuild and resettle, but they need to be prepared to move out at very short notice. So they do hazard assessment, risk assessments. And I mean, I was in Grindavik myself just, just a month ago. It's been opened up again to tourists, and they've got a fascinating display in one of the main squares showing the damage it was caused. Lots of buildings are still fenced off. You can see the cracks running across the ground, and told not to walk away from the pavements and not to walk away from the safe areas. So it felt still a little bit like a little town under siege, to be honest. Mm. But restaurants are opening up, accommodations opening up, they have optimism, and they have a resilience, because Icelanders have been living beside volcanoes for the best part of 1,200 years. It's something that's part of the psyche. They're very independent people, and they're very adaptable, and it's quite remarkable to see the way they've coped with this.
You say they're adaptable and have been living alongside volcanoes for a very long time. Have there been any innovations or improvements in how cities or towns can prepare for or deal with volcanoes?
Yes, the monitoring that Iceland does of its volcanoes is actually world-class. They have monitoring stations that are permanently in position around all the main volcanoes. And if a volcano starts to show unrest, their land starts to rise, they will put additional monitoring in place to try and get a much better handle on what's happening beneath the surface, to allow warnings to be given. They have evacuation plans in place for particularly the volcanoes along the south coast, which is one of the main tourist routes. There's quite a large number of volcanoes there. So they think about this all the time. They anticipate all the time, and remarkably few people have been injured and killed by volcanic eruptions in Iceland. And that's in a way is testimony to the getting to know them, how they behave, and what to do to get it away and how to adapt to them.
That was Dave McGarvey at the University of Lancaster in the UK, speaking with us about a volcanic eruption that's prompted evacuations in southwestern Iceland.
That's a wrap for today. Tomorrow on the show, Afghanistan takes on illegal logging. If it sounds like the Taliban are going green, that might be optimistic.
From my perspective, this has very little to do with conservation and very much to do with power balances.
Why Afghanistan is so interested in logging on the show tomorrow.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Sherry Mallon and Jonathan Abbott, Paula and Cy DeCoss, Kira and Peter McGrath, William Reynolds, and Carolyn Talcott. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.